Welcome to the First Things podcast. On this episode, the editors hold a roundtable discussion on the morning after the apocalypse, the election. Editor Rusty Reno is here, as are senior editor Mark Bauerlein and deputy editor Elliot Milko. I'm associate editor Julia Yost. Thanks for listening. Gentlemen, first question, are you surprised?
I was not surprised. I had recognized, I think, in the final month that the most predictable element of this campaign season was unpredictability, and that Trump had defied all of my expectations at every stage. So while I certainly didn't think he would win, I didn't think he would lose either. I suspended judgment, which I thought was the most rational way to approach the final weeks of the campaign.
I was absolutely certain that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And that's just because the overpowering forces of media coverage and respectable opinion across the spectrum, along with, you know, the worlds that we here at First Things move in and out of, in terms of academia, the intellectual world generally in the United States, the publishing world, just seemed to be so hardened against Donald Trump, and that formed a wall that this interloper figure simply couldn't surmount.
I'm on the same page as Mark. I was shocked. Really shocked last night. I watching the results come in, I felt like, you know, my brain was failing repeatedly over and over again. And yeah, there's something incredible about seeing the entire political class be proven wrong in such a short span of time, given the high rate of certainty. I mean, a few days ago, the New York Times was saying that Hillary had an 85% chance of winning, and then in a space of hours, Trump had a 95% chance of winning, and then he won. It gives me a sense of hope. Everything is possible now.
Right, I get that. You know, I was watching the returns as they came in, and I mean, I am very agnostic about whether a Trump presidency is going to be a good thing or a bad thing, but I found myself just so kind of existentially refreshed by the idea that something unpredictable finally was happening. And I realized that I had been so profoundly resigned to the fact that the Clintons were returning to the White House, because that's how it works. They are capital E establishment, and the House always wins. They'll be back. Also, the fact that all the polls, very consistently, with the exception of that LA Times poll that everyone made fun of, all the polls were consistently showing Clinton was going to win, not by a landslide, but she was going to win. She was inevitable. And so to find that, you know, the pundit class and the ruling class were failing, their candidate was failing, their predictions were failing, polling was failing, big data was failing. So these tools of the technocracy for surveilling and controlling ordinary folks were failing. Technocracy was failing. That makes political life unpredictable again. It makes one feel that there are possibilities again, which was something that I had not thought was possible.
Well, I do think that we've been in a long period of, or not that long, but certainly has become more acute recently, of feeling we have no options. And then we're kind of stuck. And tomorrow is just going to be today plus one. And as I travel around and talk to people, I feel a sense of kind of moral and political exhaustion that that feeling of having no options creates. And so we saw with the Brexit vote in England that human beings don't like that condition, and they'll kind of take a gamble on alternatives just to give themselves, not just to give themselves, but in part to give themselves a sense that they have some say in the future. And so I do think that this vote for Trump was a gamble that people made, But they made it in part because of that sense of frustration that you expressed, of being trapped in a circumstance where there's no exit.
No exit but Brexit.
No exit but Brexit. And also being more political animals. I mean, Aristotle says that. We want to be deliberate together about our common life. Angela Merkel speaks often about how there is no alternative. There's no alternative to the EU. There's no alternative to accepting the refugees. There's no alternative to the euro. And this no alternative is the death of a political culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
because it shuts down public discourse. I mean, I think so much of the Clinton campaign's rhetoric was apocalyptic. You know, oh, if Trump wins, the world's going to explode. There will be a nuclear winter. you know, the economy will melt down and hysteria everywhere. That it made it impossible for people to talk through why they might prefer a Trump administration or why they really couldn't support Hillary in the end. That kind of rhetoric really, it shuts down the healthy political conversations that make the system work.
When people are presented with there is no alternative and they're able to look around and say, yeah, there is. We can do this instead. And then the response to them is, no, you just don't understand. That's not political leadership. Right? That's just that's not being a representative figure in the government. That's being paternalistic and condescending. People don't like that.
I'm hearing the same things that people said coming out of the Brexit vote here. A reduction of the electoral result to sheer racism or hatred. You know, oh, I didn't realize that America had this kind of bigotry at its core. I didn't realize that we were so backward. Reduction of the result to something called white lash, right? So the idea being that we supported Obama last time, but now some sort of racist core of white supremacists has taken back America because they can't tolerate this sort of racial progress anymore. And that's very disturbing, and it's disheartening because that's not the America I know. I mean, coming from the Midwest, I have no notion of this sort of white supremacist backlash against Obama.
Selena Zito, who is a political journalist from Western Pennsylvania, I believe, wrote in The Atlantic toward the end of September, "The press takes Trump literally but not seriously. His supporters take him seriously, but not literally."
That's a good formulation. I think that's an accurate formulation. You know, he has a lot of Queens, kind of a thuggish Queens personality, Donald Trump. And, yeah, braggadocio, hyperbole, push the hot buttons. But, hey, I can work with the guy. You know, and I think that for those of us who, go to fancy schools and have professional jobs, we're well-trained to be very polite. Working class people work in workplaces where the human interaction is much more rough. And so what the pundit class was hearing as a kind of horrifying sort of degrading or racist sentiment, I think many voters heard as, this guy's going over the edge, but everybody does that sometimes.
And what this etiquette is, here we can go to actually leftist critique forms of etiquette as class formation. And one person wrote an essay saying that Trump has given the working classes in America an understanding of their class consciousness on the grounds of manners and etiquette and propriety that they actually didn't quite realize before. I don't know if that part is true.
Yeah, I wonder
true,
if that might be true. You'd have to do more looking, dig more deeply to.
I mean, how many times have we seen the etiquette be a hammer to slam people in one way or another? You have said the wrong thing. You have done the wrong thing, especially on issues of race and sexuality, where we jump on people for this, even the mildest and sometimes casual or unintentional or perfunctory crossing of these lines, and it is quite rigid in these
yeah,
elite
one of
worlds.
One of the things that I worked when I worked on an oil rig many years ago now in Wyoming, I had never really been immersed in a male honor culture, and that which I think is more characteristic of working class men. And in that honor culture, which has many very appealing aspects, also has very many unappealing aspects, someone like Donald Trump, I think, is more comprehensible. And there is a sense that it's funny, you know, the way we were very sensitive to the cultural vulnerabilities of various groups in our society, and perhaps rightly so, how insensitive we are to people's sense of loss of the legitimacy of this male honor culture.
What does this election portend for the religious right, and what does it portend for the Catholic Church in America?
Well, I don't think that this election represented any gain for the religious right. I think many of us, I would probably include myself in it, feel on occasion a kind of existential panic over the increasing vulnerability of our churches to legal invasion, so to speak. And that undoubtedly motivated some people to go to the polls. But this is really very different. In 2004, Karl Rove put defense of marriage resolutions on a number of state ballots to turn out religious voters to help reelect George W. Bush. And by all accounts, that was a successful strategy. Donald Trump did nothing like that. He did not promote or advance any particular interest of the religious right other than religious freedom. And even there, it was not a major theme in his campaign. His campaign was economic vulnerability and the cultural vulnerability or anxiety associated with immigration. Those were his two big issues. He won those issues. Those are not religious, religious right, religious conservative issues. We may have interest in those, or we may have concerns about those as citizens, but there's nothing specifically Christian. So in some sense, this election may represent the rise of the post-Christian right in America that revolves around issues, again, that they're not necessarily ones that are of, we don't care about, but they're not part of our classic concern of cultural values. I mean, obviously Trump's personal life itself is certainly not going to reinforce the kinds of cultural values that the religious right wants to promote. So I think it'd be wrong to interpret this as in some way a vindication of the religious right. Not at all.
I'm a little more positive about Trump's impact on the church, the conservative churches, and it's more practical than this. I simply think that what Trump is going to do with his executive branch is to pull back the anti-discrimination regime, the one that is issuing Dear Colleague letters to schools, that is pushing for more discrimination complaints on identity grounds. I think there's a lot that the president sets the agenda for many of his agencies. They do what he wants them to do. And if Hillary were in office, I believe that the Catholic Church would find itself having to hire a lot more lawyers and would be in court, church and church-related institutions, including colleges. I think that will scale down significantly.
I agree with Mark. I think that's right, that the gain comes from relief of pressure. But, you know, two decades ago, certainly three decades ago, our vision was that with the right kind of political engagement, we can roll back the 1960s, and we can roll back the excesses of the 1960s. Well, we have failed in that regard. And I think the whole LGBT project is pretty much baked into our political culture for the short to medium term. And so while a Trump administration is going to de-emphasize that and therefore relieve pressure, it's not, I don't think it's going to reverse course on this. And in that sense, we're really in a very different place politically. And I think we need to be appreciative and certainly need to reward political candidates who call off the dogs, so to speak, and defang human rights campaigns' efforts to really drive us into the ground. So we should definitely be grateful and we should reward them with our votes, but we should not confuse that with what was possible, what we thought was possible 30 years ago.
And I think the practical judgment might you know, come down to this, especially with the case in Virginia of Gigi going to the Supreme Court. Will the Trump administration pull back the insertion of gender identity into Title IX? It's very simple, right there.
Right, I think that's a great.
What position will they take on that?
And the fact that you and I don't know is just a good sign that his campaign did not run on that issue and did not make any promises on that issue, at least not any explicit promises on that issue. And so again, that really is very different from the way in which Republican candidates courted the religious right for an entire generation, making promises which, as we know, are often not fulfilled, but nonetheless were made. And here we don't really even have promises. So I think we're in a different position now, and we need to be grateful that we're not going to be subjected to, you know, a Clinton administration and just more hammering on, especially on the sexual politics, but that we need to use the moment of relief of this pressure to think deeply about what contribution we can make to our civic life.
I guess the coalition that elected Trump reminds me a little bit of the peculiar fusion that drove Democratic dominance through the middle of the 20th century between a sort of pro-agrarian populism that was very pro-government with FDR and the New Deal and then the Great Society of Lyndon Johnson. So the fusion between that and sort of lost cause Southern social conservatism, right?
they were not obvious bedfellows.
Not obvious bedfellows, but it worked, and it worked for a long time. And there were intense conflicts, but because they shared the ticket, they won a lot of elections. And I wonder if, I mean, I don't see how this could happen right now, but maybe it could, maybe I'm just not seeing it. I wonder if the Republican Party going forward could shed some of the economic vestiges of Reaganism and neoconservatism and become this sort of populist fusion party of a sort of Trump-style pro-worker protectionist platform with social conservatism and values voters. And if that happened, it could do good things for religious conservatives in America, because I think that the ethos of the people, these sort of salt of the earth types who elected Trump, is with religious conservatives.
I'm not convinced that that's the case. Maybe in part, but only in part. So I just don't see, you know, the constituency that voted for him is a very de-Christianized constituency, statistically compared to the more educated population, which is now more likely to go to church, not less likely. So I think it's a really open question about how much social conservatism, the base of the Trumpian base, really wants. I don't know. I think it's an open question. It would depend on leadership, I think, to convince this constituency that, if you will, a kind of soft social conservatism. I don't think we can go to some kind of restoration of earlier social mores, but some kind of pro-family, pro-marriage, hard work, treat your neighbors with decency sort of ethic, I think does have traction. I do agree, but we as leaders of social conservatives and religious right leaders have not actually done the work to formulate that kind of, it's going to be a sub-Christian ethic, I think, or in the way that it has to be, you know, I don't think we can go back on divorce, for instance. I mean, I think we can nibble away at no-fault divorce. But pornography, can we really make headway with any kind of attempt to roll back pornography? You know, violent video games, can we really make headway with that? I don't know whether legalization of marijuana, I'd have to look at the vote in a place like California and ask myself, is the vote for legalization of marijuana coming from the same sorts of people who are inclined to be the Trumpians? I would go back to Eliot's point that I do think that the Trumpian base wants something solid. They want an economic system that gives them a stable basis for their lives. They want their nation to be, you know, a culturally
But people also want to have the moral authority of a strong religious voice in the background, even if they're not living according to its precepts, right?
I
think that Middle America, even if there's been this breakdown of community, family, and faith.
Maybe you think it's all the more they want this background.
That's right, because it's...
They don't want to be judged, but they do want to be reminded.
Well, maybe they even want to be judged. Maybe they want to have that reassurance that there is something solid that they can... be born again into, or something available that will serve as the bedrock for a new second chance at life or something like that. I don't know. We could have another great awakening. Something could happen.
And remember, these were people who vote.
Yeah.
They are going to be more likely ones who do have some civic desire than the people who don't vote. Now, one question I saw was that the exit polling showed that evangelicals went 84% Trump.
Wow.
Hillary got 12%.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, my analysis is that anybody who feels like they've been beaten up in the last 8 years went heavy, heavy Trump. And religious conservatives, and I count myself among them, feel like we've been under assault during the Obama administration. And so that makes us inclined to take a chance on the guy who promises to change things. So that's the way I account for it. I mean, this is a heavily conservative group anyway. I think 75% of them went for Romney in 2012. So it's a heavy Republican vote under any circumstance. But the fact that Trump extended that huge margin even more, I think, stems from the fact that this is a demographic that feels as though it's under assault. So when I travel around and visit different, you know, churches and other groups, I feel there's a kind of existential panic among conservative Christians. And part of my message to them is, you know, relax, it's not as bad as it seems, because we tend to overinterpret the negative signals in our culture, partly because we, you know, are so used to affirmative messaging, you know, affirmative role. And it's really shocking to us to be told that actually we're bigots in impeding progress. That is a shocking thing for a person my age to hear when I was kind of raised to say that even people who are unreligious thought, well, it's a good thing for people to be religious. It makes them involved in civic matters and makes them into good people, although it's not my cup of tea. Whereas now we have a significant cohort saying, you know, we'd be a better society if we didn't have religious people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's created a very different dynamic, and I think that's drove voters, evangelical, conservative evangelical voters, to really go out strong for Trump.
What happened to fusion conservatism, and what happens to fusion conservatism going forward?
Well, if we look at fusionism, it's got the three classic pillars: free market, robust American power is good for the world, and then social conservatism. I think the Trump campaign attacked the free market pillar. It attacked the American power projected boldly abroad pillar. And it paid obeisance to, but largely ignored, the social conservatism pillar. And so looking at that, you would say that if you're a Koch brothers libertarian free marketeer, The Trump presidency is worse than the Clinton presidency, potentially.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. If you're robust projection of American power. Again, the Trump presidency is worse than the Clinton presidency that we're not going to have. If you're a social conservatism, we've already kind of discussed that. He's not a very savory character. He may not advance our issues, but he's not going to put us on the defensive. So I think fusionism is in disarray. There's no question about that. And if Trump's electoral success is any indication, the pillar of fusionism that's the least damaged, if you will, by his election is the social conservative pillar.
If there's only one pillar left, then there's no fusion.
Right.
No, I disagree. I think it's part of the American DNA, a kind of soft libertarian and certainly pro-capitalist sentiment is part of the American DNA. This will return, that whatever Trump represents in the way of pulling back from a kind of globalist ideological commitment to free trade and free movement of capital, goods, and labor, that pullback is not a pullback to something that's going to be statist in its orientation. So, and the same thing is true for American power, that whatever the Trumpianism future is going to be, we have the largest military in the world by far. We project our power throughout the world. That's not going to change. Although thinking about it and maybe reorienting that power hopefully will change, because I think our foreign policy since 1989 has not gone well, and we're due for a deep rethink. So I think fusionism on the right still remains the proper way to think about it. And the question is, how is it going to reestablish its cogency and its plausibility as a coalition? And I think a lot of it's going to depend on Trump's actions and whether what we see in the first couple of years of his presidency and whether it makes sense. And if it does make sense, what's the intellectual basis on which we can think about how to either combat it if we think it goes in a bad direction, or how we can encourage it if we think it's in some incipient way going in a positive direction.
So watching Paul Ryan's speech recognizing Trump's victory, something struck me, which was that Trump ran well. He did very well in the presidential race and on his coattails. Republicans have taken both houses of Congress. But he didn't run with a cohort of Trump-minded people. And so Paul Ryan is still Speaker of the House, for the present at least. And he still thinks and talks like Republican,
a Kempian, you know, neo-Reaganite.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Yep. And so it's unclear to me what Trump is going to do with all of these Republicans in Congress.
Well, that's why I think fusionism still is relevant. And I think that I look at you know, the intellectual trajectory there. And, you know, I think the free market capitalist ideals have continuing legitimacy, but, you know, they've clearly come up against political reality in a very significant way, not just in the United States, but in Europe as well. And I think the same goes for American exceptionalism in foreign policy. So I happen to think that social conservatism provides the richest intellectual resources to rebuild a case for limited government and for the possibility of a self-governing people.
And a Christian society.
And I do think, well, Mark did point out that I do have a book, The Idea of Resurrecting the Idea of a Christian Society, where I try to make that case. You know, I have a voice crying in the wilderness. But I do think...
What I expect is that we might see some of the fractures in the Democratic Party in the next few years that have been covered over quite effectively. I mean, people talk about what unites the Democratic Party.
Victory tends to unite, defeat tends to divide.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But what united the Democratic Party behind Obama in 2012 was identity politics.
Yep.
And that was
his
whole platform, basically. And I think that the culture, the political culture surrounding the whole identity politics complex of issues has gotten very angry and bitter during Obama's second term. And that is not appealing to people in the same way that hope, change, forward were. You know, it's no longer this straight message of tolerance and acceptance. Now it's about grinding down the last vestiges of opposition. And I don't think...
That's us.
Yeah, they're right. I don't think America wants to participate.
Right. No, if we look at the two promises that I think were made in the post-89 after the fall of the Soviet Union, the sort of focal point on the kind of East-West thing shifted, and we began to think as a society, what are our projects? And there were two projects, which is economic globalization is going to be good for America, and we're all going to get rich together. And that promise has not been vindicated, been shown to be trustworthy. Some of us have gotten quite wealthy, but others not so much. And the second was a kind of multiculturalism where we're going to build an inclusive society where everyone has a role and a place and can see themselves as part of a common project. And that promise has not been fulfilled. Instead, identity politics has tended to heighten tensions and has led to rancor and bitterness and a kind of policing of our social relations in a way that many people find, I think most people find, dissatisfying. So those two twin promises, economic prosperity for all and a kind of inclusive, affirmative society that's in genuine unity, has been discredited as well, or at least not discredited, but called into question. I do think that if Trumpism, it's an ill-defined notion, can find a vocabulary about new unity that actually makes sense in our current society, and it's not just some sort of nostalgic attempt to go back to some earlier era. And if economic policies can deliver at least some degree of prosperity on a broader basis, then it's a lasting phenomenon. Because I think Americans still want those two things. They still want broad-based prosperity in, I think, a global system. I don't think Americans want to go back to Fortress America, but they do want broader-based prosperity, and they're willing to accept compromises on the free market principles to achieve those goals. And I think also Americans want open, capacious, welcoming society that enjoys a kind of genuine unity and commonality of purpose.
Yeah, but before they want any of those things, I think they want well-developed local communities, strong families, and a sense of lifetime security, which is missing, right?
Well, I think those strong communal networks and families are necessary, actually, to have broad-based prosperity.
Of course,
because there's an interlocking relationship between, if you will, moral dysfunction and economic dysfunction.
Absolutely.
And it's also the foundation for a genuinely open, capacious, and unified society, because people are able to join communities that have rich institutional structures. They're vital. They're engaged in a common project. You know, you're shoulder to shoulder working towards a common goal rather than face to face with identity grievances.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's why I think social conservatism, broadly understood, a renewal of these loyalties and a sense of moral purpose is at the foundation of renewing fusionism.
Mm-hmm.
Can we put Trump's victory in a global context? This stuff is happening all over the world. First Brexit, now Trump. What's next?
Marine Le Pen. I think he just increased, this November 8th increased the chances that she'll be the next president of France. No question about it. These things are contagious. There's momentum. Just in the 1930s, the 20s and 30s, with failure of liberal democratic societies and the economic and political crises after World War I led to a widespread feeling that we needed something else and something different. And it gave rise to fascism and other collectivist projects. And we're in a kind of similar, it's dissimilar in many, many important ways. There's no paramilitaries rampaging in our streets. We don't have street violence. I mean, we should realize how disintegrated European society was in the 1930s. Our society is in much better shape, and certainly theirs are as well. But there's something similar of a sense that something is coming to an end and something new is being born. And this has a contagious effect across societies. and influences what people think is possible. It goes back to what you said, Julie, at the beginning, which is that the feeling like, ah, we're just stuck with the current system. Well, wait a minute. The British went against it. And now, wait a minute. The Americans have thrown that off too and embraced something different. Kind of scary, different, but it's different. And so the French may say, yeah, hey, we can do this.
It is so much different than it was in 1997. When you think back then, the globalization, there really was.
Strong consensus, and we believe it was going to work.
Everyone is, it's going to trickle down to everyone. The digital age is right. Providing great wealth. And, you know, internationally, there with the Middle East was, you know, relative to other times, you know, Clinton was working there. We had the Irish situation settling down at that time.
Prosperity is going to domesticate the entire world.
The momentum really was there. And Bill Clinton was the great international president for the post Cold War era. And boy, is that all that optimism is gone.
Right. So I think there's two lessons from that. One is it's a reminder of how these sentiments can build. But the second thing to remember is it never goes as far as you think it's going to go.
Yeah.
So what looked inevitable in 1997 turned out not to be so. This trend that we're in the midst of now, this populist trend, is not, it also is not the inevitable future. You know, there's lots of room here for statesmanship, also external events that shift and change the outcome. So I do think people who are anxious and nervous that we're living in some moment of crisis need to just chill out a little bit. Said yes, these are important dynamics that are shaking our societies, but I'm too much of an optimist here. I think that the underpinnings of certainly our society are plenty strong to endure these transformations and perhaps turn them to the best.
So is there any possibility that Trump's remaking of the electoral map is also the making of a new permanent Republican majority?
Many books have been written after every election about how this election inaugurates the end of conservatism. That was Sam Tannenhaus, or the permanent Democratic majority, or the permanent majority.
Yeah.
I think that's not the right way to see it. In a two-party system like ours, both parties reinvent themselves on a regular basis in order to capture electoral majorities. That will be ongoing. The real question is which party defines the era. The post-war era, since the end of World War II, it has been a Democratic era, in spite of the fact that Republicans have won many elections, and Ronald Reagan certainly posed a decisive modification of that Democratic era. But it was the New Deal era, Great Society era, just as the era after the Civil War was the Republican era. The decisive victory of the Union over the South meant that Republican progressivism defined American public life all the way through to 1929. And then from 1945, the Democratic FDR-LBJ party defined our priorities and agendas. We all know that because Republican politicians have to position themselves so as not to get sideways with the cultural politics of the Democratic Party progressives. So we don't know. I mean, time will tell whether we're in a moment and the Trump election is a sign that our public culture is shifting to a point where the social signals and the political priorities of the Democratic era are coming to an end and a new one is coming to be. But I guarantee you, whatever comes to be, the two parties will reinvent themselves in order to satisfy the voters in that era.
I don't even know what the American political landscape will look like on Inauguration Day.
Well put.
I think, so that's the key point, that we have tens of thousands of people who are telling us what America looks like at every given second, and they have no idea. And what was really demonstrated on election night was how ignorant the political class, the commentator class, is about the actual state of things in America, that there was this massive gap open in their knowledge, and Donald Trump stumbled into it, and he won the presidency. And no one else in the entire, you know, U.S. political consultancy world, consulting world, even thought to ask the questions that would have revealed that, right? Well, that's a little extreme, but
there's some truth to that. But that's an indication.
I include myself in that group.
Right.
But who saw this coming?
No one saw this coming.
That's an indication, though, of the fact that, you know, that could be an indication that the political realities of our country are changing, and which would make complete sense to me.
Yeah.
You know, globalization has, we've been told over and over again, technology and globalization have fundamentally transformed our society. Okay, if so, then why would the political verities that have characterized our political system since 1945 still be relevant? And those of us who have been trained in those verities and, you know, to ask polling questions in light of those verities wind up becoming less and less capable of interpreting the present political reality. So I think it's funny, you know, our pundit class, and I'm with Mark, myself included, always is reminding us how much America has changed. Big demographic changes, economic changes, technological changes, and then we assume that our politics is going to follow unchanged from what it's been for the last two generations, three generations.
So I think that coming out of this election, what's going to change is the way the consultant class directs campaigning for Republican offices across the country, because they've seen someone win in this way. And so they're going to try and parse
what exactly was it,
and how can we exploit that? And that will transform the Republican platform in the long run into what I don't know, because it's really not clear to me right now what
And the Democratic Party will do the same thing. They'll do a postmortem. Right. How did we lose voters that have voted for us in the past? Why did people not turn out when they should have turned out? Mm-hmm. Now, some of its personality, Hillary Clinton was unappealing. But then, of course, it goes the other way around, too. Donald Trump is also very unappealing. Mm-hmm. So they may actually cancel each other out in that regard. And so it could be an interesting time as people try to sort through what really happened. But my hunch is that we're only at the beginning of these changes. And so the slicing and dicing of the analysts will be interesting and obviously worth thinking about. But by the time we get to 4 years from now, things may have again, the wheel may have turned yet again.
Right.
And the electorate may be just as unpredictable as they were in this cycle.
Mm-hmm. Great. It's exciting. It's a new dawn of possibility in American politics.
You sound like Wordsworth.
That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my colleagues, Rusty Greeno, Mark Bauerlein, and Elliot Milko. Thanks to the voters of America. Whichever way you voted, you made this fun. And thank you, listeners.